we present the News Quiz with your chairman, Simon Hoggart.
Welcome again to the News Quiz, which this week comes from the Winterbowden in Bournemouth, and we start with an item from the Bournemouth Daily Echo, read by Peter Donaldson.
Crackdown on prostitution. A high-profile crackdown on prostitution is in the pipeline once the Labour Party conference is over.
Let's meet the teams now. Please welcome first on my right, Andy Hamilton and John O'Farrell. And opposite them on my left, Francis Ween and Mark Steele. Andy, here's a toughie for you. Who wants to see an end to poverty, social injustice, and relegation for Newcastle United?
Well, this, of course, is the speech of our great leader at the Labour Party group hug this week. I watched the speech. I thought it was a very forward looking speech. He mentioned the millennium a lot, you know, and my feeling about the new millennium is that we shouldn't go into the new millennium until the conditions are right. No, seriously. What I think we should do is let the rest of Europe go into the millennium. See if it starts to work, you know, see if they feel they're getting some benefit from it. Even then, I'd advocate caution. I think we should enter the millennium on a slow track, possibly letting the first decade... We could take 30 years over it, I think. But it was an impressive speech, wasn't it? It was very passionate, and I don't know what it was about. Well, I do, actually. I didn't realise that the poor man had such a difficult job. I didn't realise that as Prime Minister, he is constrained by these forces of conservatism, these elites that just stop him doing the things he needs to do. And these forces of conservatism include the IRA, the teachers, the BMA. Well, everyone who isn't him, basically.
Also, he had this very important news that the class war is over and the middle class is won. So the workers are going to have to pay reparations and so forth, as people do after the wars, and say they're very sorry and go on saying it for another 50 years and promise never to do it again. And it's all going to be wonderful, and after that we'll be one big, happy nation, one millennium, new Labour, new millennium, one people, one party state, and then the 1,000-year Reich.
They cheered everything, didn't they, the delegates? There was a bit where Blair said, I want parents to be able to drop off their children at school, not into the arms of drug dealers. And this got a huge cheer. And I thought, were the delegates thinking, oh, thank God he's come down on the right side on that one? They were so worried he was going to say, I want drug dealers to be able to sell crack to children. Without meddling parents, get in the way. They just still cheered. They cheered everything.
There was this very important revelation, apart from the class war, that the future is people, which is jolly handy to know for those of us who thought it was duck-billed platypus.
I was very very excited about that new DNA database that he announced. Apparently they're going to take the DNA of any Labour backbenchers who vote against the government, and they'll be able to store that on a national database and be given straight to the police. So that's a good step.
And why did he say at the start of the conference he denied it? It was reported that he said he wanted 10 more years to go on and on and on, and he said, no, I deny saying that. And I thought, well, why? I mean, most of your policies are nicked off Thatcher. You might as well have her catchphrases as well.
He took issue with the phrase too clever by half. You know, he said, what other country would have the expression too clever by half, as if this was an expression that denigrated intelligence. But actually, that's not quite true, is it? I mean, my understanding of too clever by half is that it's about misapplied intelligence, isn't it? It's someone who uses their intelligence to be manipulative and... I can see why he's not keen on it now.
Prime Minister Blair's speech at the conference offered the nation the vision of a brave new world where anybody could rise to become Prime Minister, except Gordon Brown. At the end of his speech, Mr. Brown quoted a Carpenter song, We've Only Just Begun. At the next week's Tory conference, Anne Widdecombe and William Hague will be singing Calling Occupants of Interplanetary Craft. Two points to somebody. John, who made sure that the British armed forces will be fighting, fit and in the pink?
Ah, yes, this is the story that gays are to be allowed in the services. They felt that an organisation full of muscly men with moustaches should perhaps allow gays in. And it's been very unfair in the past. There was one particular case on one ship where a sailor was singled out because he was the only one who wasn't gay.
Well, it's going to give new meaning to old Corporal Jones in Dad's Army, isn't it? They don't like it up 'em, sir.
It's a strange idea that the sort of old conservatives have, isn't it? That you can't be gay and be a military man. When you think, like, Julius Caesar was gay.
He wasn't, was he?
Julius Caesar was gay, yeah, he was. I mean, no, he didn't go around going, ooh, chase me, did he, and things like that. Didn't get Julius Caesar going, ooh, is that a dagger in my back, or are you just pleased to see me? Absurd, isn't it?
Absolutely true. A wartime member of the RAF wrote to The Guardian saying that only two questions were important with regard to gay men in the armed forces. Can he shoot straight? And will he watch my back? Mark, who was driven to distraction by a bad hair day?
Oh, is this the good Deputy Prime Minister we're talking about? Yes, who... I saw it today, just how ridiculous it is, this little length that he sort of went about. It's about 200 yards, and it's downhill as well. I mean, you can understand it, 200 yards on the flat. Of course you need two jags and... Because it's come from a working-class background, see, that's the thing. So the middle class is somebody who gives you a limousine, and you go, oh, well, that's rather unnecessary, I'm only going over there. But if you're from a working-class background, you go, whoa, well, we might as well get in it. Hey, they're giving it us, we might as well use it, hey. Look at, hey, Pauline, feel that, hey, look at that, that's real leather, is that? Hey, what does that thing do there, mate? That cigar lighter, I don't even smoke, stick it in there, go on, hey, put your finger in it for a laugh, go on. We're there, sir. We'll go back up and back down again. Another gadget, the working classes.
But what was very sweet was on Thursday morning, because of all this terrible publicity for Prescott, the entire cabinet had to walk from the hotel to the conference centre, and you saw them forming a crocodile, and all these people trying to get the hang of it, saying, one foot there, stick that leg out. Then it's quite easy when you try, really. And there they were all limping. Only two of them fell over, I think, in the course of it.
Prescott got very touchy. I don't know if you saw the interview where John Suchet asked him why it had been necessary to make the journey by car. And he said, well, for security reasons and because my wife didn't want her hair blown about. Now, have you got any more silly questions? And I think John Suchet should have risen to that challenge. And said, yes, do crabs think that we walk sideways? And then... And just kept hitting him with silly questions.
It's not the first time the minister responsible for the environment has made a gaffe. He's still to live down his statement, and this is true too, that the Green Belt is one of Labour's proudest achievements, and I intend to build on it. Two points to Mark. Francis, your piece of music.
No, rien de rien. No.
Jerry Halliwell there with Je ne regrette rien. Francis, whose memoirs proved to be a major publishing event?
Well, it's little Norman Lamont, isn't it? Big Norman these days. The Times is serialising his autobiography. I think the Times has perhaps slightly oversold these things. On Monday morning, they had a huge thing on the front page saying, exclusive, the Lamont years. What Lamont years? I don't remember them. I mean, future historians going to say, well, we had, you know, the Roaring Twenties and the Hungry Thirties, the Swinging Sixties, and then the Lamont years. And they've been running it all week. I don't suppose anyone's read a word of it.
Actually, I read his memoirs today, and it was the account... I know. Well, I've led a sad life. And he was giving an account of how he was told he was resigning. And apparently John Major asked him to come into his room at 10 Downing Street, got him to sit next to him, which he thought was a bit odd, and then said, "I want you to know, Norman, that I really like you as a person." Now, he must have been thinking, "Bloody hell, I'm in trouble now." What have I done? You would know something dreadful was going to happen.
I think that's more depressing than losing $20 billion on Black Wednesday, is knowing that John Major likes you as a person.
Yes, Norman Lamont's memoirs In Office were serialised this week. In them, he claims that on Black Wednesday, while Britain was losing billions of pounds, John Major dithered about withdrawing from the ERM. Back in September 1992, then, we had a Prime Minister and a Chancellor seemingly working together as a team, when, in fact, in secret, the two men despised each other. It's a great comfort to know that nothing like that could happen today. The scores at the end of the easy round are everybody 4 points. Before we start the harder round, here's a cutting from the Cotswolds and Evesham Y magazine.
Diamond cluster gold engagement ring, forever engraved inside band, only 6 months old.
Thanks to Roger Davies and Ulster for that. John, who outfoxed the Labour conference?
Ah, yes, this is the pro-hunting lobby, and they marched on the conference, and they were all interviewed on the television saying things like, "Well, we're not a bunch of toffs." there are some commoners here. In fact, they're carrying me at the moment. Now this, yes, they sort of walked straight into Labour's carefully laid trap and made Hague look like a complete idiot for being one of the few pro-hunters left in the country. But I think next time there's a march, next time there's a countryside march through London, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to grab one of them and drag them down an alleyway, and I'm going to nick their watch, and I'm going to nick their wallet. And when they object to this, I'm going to say, "You country folk, you just don't understand the ways of the city, do you?"
I'm very confused by the differing statistics of the two sides, because the anti-Hun lobby say that they would lose, I think it's 900 jobs, and the pro-Hunt lobby say that if you ban fox hunting, you'll lose 16,000 jobs. Now, that's a big gap. I think they're counting the hounds. I think that's the only explanation. But it seems to me that there are viable alternatives whereby the hounds do not have to be destroyed. They can still be gainfully employed for hunting. They can have drag hunts. I mean, I'm personally... I'm opposed to chasing men dressed as women across fields. I think that's a retrograde step. You know, we let gays into the armed forces and then we start hunting drag queens. I think that's... I think that would be a shame. But, I mean, those horses and hounds could be used to hunt truants. I think Jack Straw would like that. Kid bunks off from school, you know, he's down the Arndale, thinks he's safe.
Yes, 16,000 Countryside Alliance supporters gathered here in Bournemouth to voice their displeasure at the government. Many politicians have laughed off one farmer's suggestion that next year he'd bring an enormous muck spreader with him, saying they were sure Alistair Campbell could find his own way to the conference. Mark, listen to this.
This old house is getting shady. This old house is getting old. This old house that's in the rain. This old house that's in the cold.
Which British architect, Mark, ain't got time to fix the German Parliament?
I've got a clue.
Norman Foster.
Yes.
Is that a clue, Francis?
That's clue. No, it's the answer.
It's a sort of clue.
I'm
come
thinking,
answer.
I don't know, I've got much idea. I wonder if it's sort of... Is it Norman Foster?
Yes,
what is he hasn't got time to do, Simon?
He hasn't got time... Well, he hasn't had his last payment from the Reichstag in Berlin, which he designed. Their parliament building is falling down, so they claim. He denies this, and he says he's owed £1.5 million. and they're holding back until he comes and fixes the loos.
They've just finished rebuilding the Reichstag, have they, after that fire? Was it a problem with the insurance or something coming through? I suppose then there was the Second World War and everything, wasn't there, as well?
There's probably a load of them going, yeah, and there was four stereos in that room. And a microwave. Yeah, that got burnt down, was it?
The German government is withholding payment for Lord Foss's all-glass reconstruction of the Reichstag. Despite becoming a popular tourist attraction, German MPs have complained there aren't enough places to sit and have denied this is because locals have bagged all the best seats with their towels. Francis, 2 points to you, but now your main question, who was teed off at the Americans?
Oh, it's the Ryder Cup, isn't it?
It is.
There's this game called golf, I believe, and for years, it's taken a lot of trouble to cultivate this image as the most boring thing on earth. And now this is all in jeopardy because of the nasty Americans, because they won the Ryder Cup back. And they celebrated on the 17th green, dancing around. And this is regarded as unsporting. So it's become an international incident, I think, pretty well. There's a man called Sam Torrance, I think, who's a European golfer, apparently. I don't know about these things. Who said on Sky TV when the Americans were celebrating, "This is the most disgusting thing I have ever seen in my life." I thought, what lovely lives golfers must have.
The competition comes to Europe, to the Belfry, next time, and already the Europeans are talking about making it more difficult when they're going for a crucial putt on the green, you know, between them and the hole. There should be a concrete helter-skelter that they've got to get. Get the ball around. And an annoying dad saying, no, come on, you get through there in a minute, you know.
Criticism of the raucous behaviour of America's victorious Ryder Cup team led to its captain, Ben Crenshaw, resigning. On the final day, Crenshaw told his players they were Americans going to war, which explains why they all turned up an hour and a half late to tee off. And the scores at the end of round two are thrillingly everybody with 8 points. Andy, which bishop felt like a pawn in the game?
Now, I didn't read this because I find it too upsetting.
It was the Bishop of Hull's wife who ran off with a
nice woman.
She's lovely.
Yeah, very nice. Yes. We're just going to have a gossip now, everybody. Just
you didn't as well, did you, at that party?
No. I was in with the coats in that room.
The vicar of Dartmouth.
Yes.
With the Bishop of Hull's wife.
I'm following this.
And the Bishop of Hull's wife got fed up with him, you know, having to work on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And
leaving his crook lying around.
And she just went off with the vicar because she was fed up with being a posh bishop's wife and she fancied a bit of rough.
Isn't that happens so many times, doesn't it? Those bishops' wives, you know, they are real goers.
And you don't get rougher than the vicar of Dartmouth.
I feel me and John should be doing this question sort of leaning over a garden fence like that.
Bishop Frith said he first suspected his wife might be having an affair when he discovered an unfamiliar cassock in the dirty laundry basket. John, your piece of music. John, which company hopes its new deal with the Pentagon doesn't have an escape clause?
Ah, yes. This is Group 4 have got the deal to run the security at the Pentagon. It's the most sensitive... I know, that's all I want to say. It's the most sensitive security site in the world. And they're handing it over to a company that, you know, when they drive British prisoners around, they say, look, I've had a few beers. Can you drive yourself to Dartmouth? they're very confident, the Americans, that Group 4 can handle this, and this has been confirmed by their head of security, Mr. Abu Nidal.
When I arrived at the theatre tonight, and was waved in by the Group 4 operative, John. Just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah, I mean, people in Bournemouth must have been suffering all week, because, I mean, half of Bournemouth, you can't even go to get your morning paper or anything without going through 25 security checks and people frisking you and snipers and people running up and down with one of those things that Diana Ross got upset about. If she'd have been here, she'd have been going mad, wouldn't she? And you go through all that just so they can have a conference that nobody's allowed to discuss anything or disagree with anything, so they might as well next year just have a dinner party. Leave the poor people of seaside towns alone.
Back.
I got angry then, didn't I?
Yeah, it was good. It was
very impressive.
It was, you had that Tony Blair gleam in your eye then.
The troubled security concern Group 4 is to install a new smart card-based security system in the Pentagon. The scheme will involve placing a smart card into one of a thousand hole-in-the-wall machines to gain entry. It was welcomed by Pentagon officials, though they don't like having to pay a pound to Barclays every time they use it. Mark, who believes that the future is plastic?
Help me again, Francis.
Oh, it's some story about plastic, I rather suspect.
This is the story of a genetically modified crop, which is going, instead of sort of producing barley or tomatoes, is going to produce plastic. And they're going to harvest plastic from this plant, and then they can use it to make all the usual things that you make, like plastic houseplants.
True. Scientists are close to a genetic breakthrough that could see plastic grown in fields, but they had to stop recently when a group of militant housewives trashed a field of genetically modified Tupperware. The scores at the end of round three are excitingly Francis and Mark with 11, but Andy and John have taken a sudden lead with 13 points. And before we start the final round, here's a clipping from the Mercury.
A man driving to the rescue of a broken-down, camouflaged army lorry failed to see the vehicle and collided with it.
Thanks to David Mason of Litchfield for that. Andy, your piece of music. I'm a fire starter, twisted fire starter. You're a fire starter, twisted fire starter. Prodigy with fire starter. Andy, whose blazing career was a fire non-starter?
Was that the Prodigy? Wasn't yeah. Vera Lynn then? I did see this story. This is a rather sweet tale of a fireman who never attended a fire.
No people were burned. Oh.
I think he was a fireman for a long time, his whole career, in fact. And he never attended a fire. He got so bored, he was reduced to throwing cats up trees and then going and rescuing him. But he's retiring, isn't he? He's retiring and...
They're doing a big cake and there's going to be all these candles on it. Yeah. And they're just going to leave it there. you know what's going to happen.
So that's the story. It's a fireman. It's a non-story. It's the fireman who never saw any fires.
Yes, fireman Colin Lynge is about to retire without ever having put out a fire, just like the men of Trumpton. Colin has worked for 29 years at Bristol Airport, but despite the lack of fires, he says he's been perfectly contented. Every day, he gets to pull out his hose and polish his helmet.
You can't have the Prodigy followed by jokes about helmets on Radio 4.
That's good going to work at an airport for 29 years and not see fire, because there was one crash, wasn't there? And apparently it was quite dramatic, and the plane crashed on the runway, and he dashed out there with his fire tender, but there was no fire. So presumably all the passengers coming off, there's a fireman going, "Dow."
He was caught with some firelighters and a box of matches.
Mr. Lynch hasn't given up hope. He's going to use his retirement money to buy a holiday cottage in Wales. John, what's ginger and brings a tear to your eye?
Ah, this is the story of a poor child who went on Chris Evans's show and was made to cry. The producer said to this little child, "You're going to meet Chris Evans," and she burst into tears. Yes, this was some... that he's been censured, I think, by the ITC or the Broadcasting Standards Association or someone by saying, "You haven't won the speedboat." And this poor child felt terrible, and his parents were disappointed, and Chris Evans is in trouble. And they're going to, you know, they're going to tell him off, and he's going to, you know, walk away with his £1 million cheque and his Rolls Royce and go, "Oh, no."
Well, I'm going to stick up for Chris Evans here, because it all hinged around the ruling by the ITC as to whether the child was distressed or not, whether this seven-year-old was upset, and they've ruled that he was. But I would say that if there's anybody who's going to understand what goes on in the mind of a seven-year-old, it's Chris Evans.
Chris Evans was censured by the Independent Television Commission for reducing children to tears on his show TFI Friday. Industry sources describe what Evans got was a slap on the wrist, rather than the punch in the mouth we'd all like to see him get. 2 points to John. Francis, whose clear improvement is the toast of the nation?
Magimix?
Yes.
Magimix. Well, that's the answer. They've invented a transparent toaster. Nothing better to do with their time. They've decided that there are apparently quite a lot of people who want a transparent toaster, who really mind about these things and would like to see their toast cooking. So they've invented one. And they're now working on a machine which allows you to watch paint dry. It's just two glass sides with some strange little gizmo inside that cooks the toast, and you look through the glass and you think, "Oh, that's done. I'll have it now." They claim it's a huge problem, burnt toast, that people are just incapable of cooking toast because they can't see it while it's cooking, and so they don't know if it's burnt or not. I mean, I've never found this problem. It's very easy getting toast well done. You just say to your butler, "I'd like a couple of slices of toast."
The French manufacturers Magimix have come up with a new all-glass toaster. The new toaster can be used with bread, crumpets and even muffins. Though it does appear that people who live with glass toasters shouldn't toast scones. Well, let's look at the final scores, which show that Francis and Mark have an excellent 15, but Andy and John are this week's winners with 17 points. And we leave you with an announcement heard on a British Airways flight from Marrakesh to Gatwick by Sarah Wookie of Chipping Norton.
"We are about to experience some turbulence. I advise all passengers to return to their seats and fasten their seat belts. If you have to use the lavatory, you may, but on your own heads be it."
With that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Francis Wheen and Andy Hamilton, Mark Steele and John O'Farrell. The chairman was Simon Hoggett, and the news is read by me, Peter Donaldson. The chairman's script was written by Dave Cohen, Tom Jameson and George Poles, and the producer was Lucy Armitage.